find ourselves now at chapter 4, Work at a Natural Pace. Now, the story that opens this chapter, remember the principal chapters, as I discussed in the last chapter's commentary, have a clear structure. Story that introduces the principle, explanation about why that principle is relevant to modern workers, modern knowledge workers, and the propositions that explore all sorts of different ways of actually putting that principle into action. So the story that opens this chapter and introduces the second principle comes from John Gribbin's book, The Scientist. Now, why this is important is I think this story, so in particular, these ideas from the book, The Scientist, the examples I found in there, was when I coined the term slow productivity. I'm want to be careful about this, but I think this is right. It was the summer of 2021. I was on vacation with my family, was reading The Scientist, and I had this idea of, whoa, Galileo, Newton, Marie Curie, they work hard, but they're not very busy. Like, they take a long time. Their stuff took a while. We see them through the lens of history as being very productive. But if you zoomed in, kind of like John McPhee, if you zoomed in, you see that Galileo is playing the lute, which he was really into, and hasn't really touched his masterwork for the last 2 years. Like, it was such a slower up and down pace. This was the very first thing I encountered that really pushed me towards the idea that, oh, there's a philosophy here that is specifically an alternative definition of productivity. And if you go back, you'll see I wrote an article while there in Maine where on my blog, where I think I might have introduced slow productivity as a term for the first time. And it was called On Pace and Productivity. So if you're hearing this audio commentary, you probably pre-ordered my book. So one of the bonuses I gave the people who pre-ordered the book was this collection of all my writing on slow productivity, all the articles I wrote before the book, and this is in there. So this story is like the original story, even though it doesn't show up until page 111. I thought about opening the book on this, but I came across McPhee after this story, and I thought it was a clear distillation of what I wanted to say. But this was the original story. It was the original story that got me thinking about productivity. Another quick thing I want to note, there's a little bit of a forced element to this principle, but I didn't know how else to get this into the book. Let's look at the definition for principle 2. Here, I'm reading from the book now. Don't rush your most important work. Allow it instead to unfold along a sustainable timeline with variations in intensity in settings conducive to brilliance. All right, what part of that is not a clean fit with work at a natural pace? The last bit, settings conducive to brilliance. Right, because look at all the other parts of this definition. Don't rush, unfold on a sustainable timeline, have variations in your intensity. All of that matches an intuitive understanding of what I might mean by natural pace. Work in settings conducive to brilliance has nothing to do with pace, but I wanted to talk about that somewhere in the book. Ritual and location. It really is a big part of slow productivity, is like the beautiful location, the ritual around where you work. It's hard when you think about slow productivity not to conjure the novelist with their cup of tea in the garden and the quaint town where they live as they walk through the woods. I mean, that personifies for a lot of people slow productivity. So I needed this in there somewhere. It could have gone in the next principle, obsess over quality, right? Because that could have been a way to try to get more quality, but it's not really about quality. It really is about connecting to your work and making it more sustainable. So I just added it on there, put a comma and said, in settings conducive to brilliance. One other thing I want to note is a little aside. So in my explanation section of this chapter, from foraging to the invisible factory, or why knowledge workers should return to a more natural pace, I really like that phrase, invisible factory. It's what knowledge workers do when we try to work these 8-hour shifts at full intensity, demonstrating our value through email and Slack and attending meetings. All sorts of visible activity is our way of showing productivity. So when I wrote an op-ed recently for the New York Times to help promote the book, we adapted this part of this chapter to an op-ed. I talked about the invisible factory, and at the last minute, the editor changed it to virtual factory. I don't know if I like Virtual Factory because this predates virtual work. The Invisible Factory just means, you know, we go to our office, we work like a factory shift, even though we're not actually in a factory. So I'm going to say I disagree with the New York Times editors there. I think Invisible Factory is a cool, that's a cool way of saying it. Another quick note for audiobook people. Turns out if you're using languages from forager communities in sub-Saharan Africa, whose languages use as clicks, beware when it comes time to have to pronounce these on an audio tape. So the name of this community, it has, you'll see the, and I don't remember exactly how to pronounce it now, but it was like the Juhansi. There's a slash and an asterisk. That's actually part of the way you transliterate the a click language. and the producer looked up how to say this word. We didn't do the clicks, but she looked up how to do it. And again, I'll just give you a little look, peek inside the curtain. When I had these hard to pronounce words, I would type out transliterations, right? How to pronounce the word in a way that I, you know, not the way it's spelled, but in the way that you would pronounce it, transliterations. And I would type it into notes on my phone. And I'd be holding these notes right in front of my face, right behind a microphone. And so they're right there. It's like, okay, I got to say this word I don't know how to say. And I'd have my custom transliteration in front of me. Again, audiobooks are no fun. But anyways, this is a good chapter. And yes, I had to add a little into it because I had to go somewhere. I wanted settings in there. So that's where I put it. Oh, one other aside, or I'm flipping through this as I talk to you, but I want to give credit where credit's due. There's an interlude in this chapter called "Didn't Jack Kerouac Write On the Road in 3 Weeks?" There's this myth that he told and spread that he wrote On the Road basically in this one quick session over a very short amount of time. And the reality is he spent 6 years. There was one section where he typed out a whole long draft of it on telegraph paper and fine. But he spent 6 years trying to get the book right. Anyways, this was not my, I didn't come across this story. It was one of my editors, Nikki. So hat tip to Nikki, who this had been something that had bothered her for years that people got this story wrong. And she mentioned it at some point. And I said, that would be perfect for the book. So that's a hat tip there to Nikki.